Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. I just spoke with Christopher I. Beckwith about his new book, Warriors of the Cloisters, The Central Asian Origins of Science in the Medieval World, and that came out with Princeton University Press in 2012. Now, this is a book that's particularly exciting in the context of the history of science as a field for at least a couple of reasons. First, it looks at a geographical context that we simply don't know much about in the history of science, that is Central Asia, that I think increasingly over time and as we move forward in the discipline is going to prove more and more central to the way we understand certainly the early and early modern history of science and medicine and technology in a global context. So in that respect, it's really interesting. In another respect, it's also really interesting, and that is it gives us a way to think about the movement of science and the circulation of science, the translation of science, not as a translation or a circulation of content of particular topics, but rather as the movement of certain methodologies or forms and spaces of argumentation. And you'll see that developed in different ways over the course of our discussion, and that reflects the ways that it's developed in the course of the book. Now, over the course of the conversation, we talked about a number of things that come up in the book, including the possible future directions of incorporating an attention to different forms of law to the development of science, including kind of opportunities to look at the potential ramifications for the history of science of moments like the Crusades. There are lots of points that emerge from the conversation and that certainly emerge from the book that really are potentially generative of a lot of further scholarship beyond the book itself. And so it's a very rich project, and I think it's a project that is particularly important contribution in the spaces that it opens up for future scholars to work on as well. It was really interesting to talk with Chris, and I hope you enjoy.
We're here today to talk with Christopher I. Beckwith about his new book, Warriors of the Cloisters, The Central Asian Origins of Science in the Medieval World. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Chris, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you, Carla. It's nice to talk to you, too.
So, Chris, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you to the field of Central Asian studies, the study of Central Asia?
Well, it's actually a very long story, so I think it would take most of our time to go into that. But I guess the short version is that when I was in between, I'd begun graduate school, I think, already in Chinese literature. And I had come back from Taiwan, where I was studying, and I read a book that my mother had from the library about a Russian explorer who had been in Central Asia in, I think, the 19th century, and his discovery of, I think it's the it's a fictionalized version of the man who discovered Kharahoto, a city in Inner Mongolia, deserted, abandoned city. And all the manuscripts were found there and everything. It was a very interesting story, and it was written in a fascinating way. And I think that got me interested for the first time in Central Asia as such. And I had been interested and Tibetan things a little bit before, because when I was in high school, I read some books about Tibet. But I guess that's really where the Central Asian studies thing started. Although my interest, when I started doing Central Asia, it just didn't follow up that early interest in the sort of archaeological things, or the Harhota for that matter, but other things. But anyhow, that's how I got into it. It's just because I read somebody's book, and it was a good book. It was called Kukushkin. That's the name of the book.
Kukushkin.
Yeah, I don't remember the author or anything else.
I'm going to write that down. So what kind, I mean, Central Asian studies, and just knowing this a little bit from starting to work a little bit in this field and teaching this subject, there's a very particular skill set that's involved in doing work in this field in terms of language training and other kinds of training. What kind of training did you have in order to prepare you to do this kind of work? And especially for perhaps listeners who might be interested in this field, but who might not know kind of where to start to prepare themselves for work in this field.
This is a very good question. And it's a question that I have to deal with all the time with graduate students who are interested in becoming scholars. So I have to tell them pretty much the answer so I can tell you pretty straightforward. What I found out while working on, I was a Tibetan major at the time for my doctorate. And I was also, but I was also doing other fields of Central Asia and Central Eurasia. So I had three different fields, basically. And I discovered that I became interested in Old Tibetan. And Old Tibetan was a language, a written language that is, the materials date from the very end of the 7th century the cutoff date depends on different people's interpretations, maybe around 1000 AD. And so I was working on this language with my professor, and I got more and more interested in the topic of some of the documents. I had been mainly interested in the language, and I got interested in the topic. Some of the texts we were reading were just fascinating, the Old Tibetan Annals and the Old Tibetan Chronicle especially. And so I discovered that in order to find out more about the period and the history that these things, these texts were talking about, well, I already had studied Chinese and was able to read the classical Chinese histories that were relevant to it. So that's the most important language for that particular period in history. But there were others, which I partly worked on. I'd learned some Arabic, and I realized that I needed to brush up my Arabic and to do this period and that area. And there were other languages, which I had studied some Turkish, but I needed to learn some Old Turkic. So I took an Old Turkic class, and there are other languages for which there aren't any narrative historical accounts. So I focused from my my early work after my doctorate on this topic of the Tibetan Empire and Central Asia. That was the topic of and the title of my first book, on this period and that area. And in order to do that, when I needed to do Old Tibetan and classical Chinese and classical Arabic and Old Turkic, and there are other things that are, you know, documentary sources, letters and legal documents, things like that. That sort of thing, which it's very important for giving us a fuller picture and more complete picture of the cultures back then. But for my particular topic, I decided that I wasn't going to do that. And so that meant I didn't really need to learn Sogdian. And I wanted to learn Sogdian desperately and couldn't manage to get my professor, who knew Sogdian, I couldn't get him to teach me for one reason or another. But and there are other things which would have been useful. For example, this is an area of Buddhist culture at that time. So the entire area was Buddhist or was adopting Buddhism. And so, of course, the knowledge of Sanskrit and other Indic languages would have been great. And I really did want to learn it, but I never just had the chance somehow. I had 2 weeks of Sanskrit, but it's not necessary for writing the narrative history. What I did for that book, it wasn't necessary, but it certainly would have helped to be an Indologist as well as a Sinologist and Tibetologist and all the other ologists that you need to do to be in order to do that topic in that area. And that's the case with any period. And I tell the students that that you have to first decide kind of what period you're going to do. And also Central Eurasia is kind of a big area. And so if you're further to the east, closer to China, well, you obviously have to know Chinese. And depending on what you're doing, you might need to pick up Japanese as well to be able to read the secondary scholarship. And if you're further to the west, closer to Europe, well, then, of course, you need to know Greek and probably Latin as well, but mainly Greek to be able to read a lot of the literature, a lot of the sources, which are only Greek for the early period, if you're doing the early period, up until basically up until the end of the Byzantine Empire. So Greek remains an important language. And, of course, Persian as well, depending on the period. Later on, New Persian comes in around about 10th century AD. And you have historical sources in Persian. There are almost none before that. So, you know, and so on. And depending on the area, partly, but also on the period. And if you come down to the more recent times, like in the East, well, from the Mongol period on, the Mongol period, you pick up, you have Mongol then. And then when you get closer to the modern times, you get Manchu. This is very rich sources in Manchu. The Manchu Empire was huge and very powerful and important. So just for all that entire area of Eastern Eurasia, you have all this stuff in Manchu. And then the secondary literature, probably the most important single language, people that are working on are Japanese, and things are in Japanese mostly.
And for Manchu studies, Russian also is crucial, right?
Russian is important too, yes, that's true. And then, of course, for later Mongol studies, particularly like the Dzungars, that's the most important research language, because the most published research that I know of on the Dzungars is in Russian. So, yeah, that's true. In Russian, it becomes more and more important as time goes on, because a lot of that area, it's now, you know, part of, was part of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. It's still, most of it to the east is part of Russia.
Right. I teach Manchu at University of British Columbia, and so when students get excited about it and come to me, they always kind of freak out at the beginning. They go, oh, what am I going to do? The dictionaries are in Russian and in Japanese, yeah. And just start somewhere. just start somewhere.
Start some Manchu. Yeah, that's it.
So
that's a good point.
So the book at hand, the book that we'll be talking about, which if I haven't already said, I really, really enjoyed, and I think is a really important addition to the literature of the history of science. So I'm really excited to have a chance to talk with you about this today. This book explores the ways that something called the recursive argument method, or what we might call, and what you call occasionally in the book, the medieval scientific method, and the institution of the college were transmitted from Buddhists to Muslims in Central Asia, and from there to medieval Western Europe. And we'll get into, in the course of the conversation in a few moments, what each of these things mean and the reasons why they're important. How did you come to this topic in particular, especially given you've published a lot and there's a wealth of material that you've studied in other areas of Central Asian history? How did you come to this particular topic, and where does this fall for you within the larger trajectory of your work?
Excellent question. I was asking myself that, anticipating you that you would ask them such a question, and it's not easy. I remember having somehow gotten interested in the issue of argument structure because I was aware of the Tibetan literature, more recent literature, I guess, late medieval and on. They have this very unusual method of structuring an argument, and I wanted to understand it, and I thought I understood how it worked. I didn't, but I thought I did, and I looked into almost nothing was written about it, so I looked into what literature there was about similar methods that I thought, you know, were similar. I thought they were similar to the Tibetan one, and so I looked into, of course, the ones in Arabic, anything in Chinese. I didn't find anything there. And the closest one that I thought was the medieval Latin one. Well, I worked on it, and I just could not find anything that would really link them together. There was something that was similar, I thought, but I couldn't find it. I finally ended up publishing an article. I think it's not a very good article on this, and abandoned the topic. And there were several reasons for that. One was that I thought that one of the main things that would help clarify the issue would have been Central Asian, ancient and early medieval Central Asian texts with argument, this kind of an argument structure or something like what I thought was a three-part argument structure. Well, okay, we have to go back, take an eraser, you know, and erase all of that. That's all was all wrong. But because I was focused on this when I was working on my previous book that came out in 2009, Empires of the Silk Road, and that's just a general history of Central Eurasia from the Bronze Age to the present, as it says in the title. While working on that, I got to the point where Xuanzang, the great Buddhist traveler from the Tang Dynasty, the 7th century, was traveling through Central Asia, and he stopped in Balkh. Balkh was this once great city in what is now northwestern Afghanistan. It was visited by Alexander the Great. It was called Bactra in ancient times, and it's the home of the Bactrians. Bactrian camel presumably comes from that area. But anyway, he was in Balkh, ancient Bactra, and there was this huge monastery there, which is very unusual. He describes it, and I'd studied this account before and written about it. But I wanted to know more about these texts. That one of the texts that he acquired there was the largest text in the entire Chinese Buddhist canon, or the collection of all the holy scriptures of Buddhism translated into Chinese. It's an entire volume. It's just gigantic work. He got a copy of it there. He studied it with the great teacher who was at that monastery. It was called the New Vihara. In Balkh, and he studied it there, and he got a copy of it, and he took it back to China and eventually translated the entire thing into Chinese. So we have it. But I couldn't understand it. It was impenetrable to me, this weird kind of Chinese. I had read Buddhist texts before, but they were more narrative-like sutra sort of things, and that side of this, birth stories and simple stuff. And this was very technical and extremely complex, and I couldn't understand the language at all. I had no training in Chinese Buddhism at all. So I just had to put that aside. I couldn't deal with it. Well, I'd asked somebody back when I worked on that first paper. I'd been told she was interested in this. I said, well, this Collette Cox was at the University of Washington, not far from where you are. She said, she sent me a message saying, well, yeah, I'm interested in it, but I haven't really gotten into it yet, or something like that. And so I just didn't know what to do. And that's one of the reasons why I abandoned it that first time. While working on my book recently, I thought, I'll just check with Collette Cox again. So I wrote her a message and she said, well, as a matter of fact, just finished an article with Hiromichi Takeda, who is a Japanese Buddhologist, and it's coming out soon, you know, and it has since then been published. And she sent me a pre-publication copy, and I opened it up and I, you know, started reading this PDF, and there it was, you know, it's exactly what I was looking for. It's this argument, fantastic argument structure, and it was similar to the European one. And nothing like the Tibetan one. Well, I thought it, still thought at that time the Tibetan one was like it, but I just couldn't understand why the Tibetan one seemed at the same time so different. I just couldn't make the match. But and somehow at that approximately that time it happened because I was working on the general history and dealing with the Arabs and the rise of Islam and the development of science in Central Asia in the early Middle Ages and High Middle Ages. And so I was reading about Avicenna and things like that. And I just looked, I thought, well, I'll just look into Avicenna's, you know, one of his books and check the translation. Of course, it's again, very complicated, highly technical, philosophical, like or scientific language, which I was not accustomed to reading. I've read historical narrative texts. That's what I did in Arabic up until then, geography and things like that. So I got some translations, French and English translations of some of things, his metaphysics, and that's what I started with, I think. And just by luck, I chose the metaphysics, as a matter of fact. because bang, there it was. I saw it. And I don't know how I didn't see that before. I never thought of it. But there it was. And this fine scholar of medieval and Islamic studies who I'd been inspired by when I worked on my first article on it, I went back and looked through his book again. And I thought that, okay, I thought his points, I still thought his point, basic point was right, that there was a connection. But he didn't demonstrated. And so here I found the thing that he hadn't been able to point out and show an actual example of it. And this was translated into Latin in the middle of the 12th century. So, bam, you know, I like solved two or three problems in my mind all at once. And I thought, oh, this is great. You know, I have to find out more about this. So I just plunged into it and then went through this era. I looked through the Arabic stuff. I tried finding more examples, and I found more things by Avicenna. And it was hard to find more in Arabic. I found just by chance, and I thought, okay, there is this guy who was an important, somewhat later philosopher, theologian, more a theologian than a philosopher, I think, but people differ on that, who wrote lots of stuff and fortunately preserved, although most of it's preserved. That's an important criterion. If you don't have the text that they wrote, then you can't say what they were thinking about it. And I found that he uses it too. It's very interesting the way he does it. This is Fakhreddin Razi. So I found two examples, and I'm sure there are many more, but it's really not my thing, you know. And this is the sort of thing that Islamists need to do. Mm-hmm. I keep pointing this out in the book, you know, well, that's not my thing, you know. I can read Arabic, yeah, depending on. And I had to read and translate some of these things, and it was very difficult. That and the Indologists also need to work on it too, from a different point of view than they've done, and Tibetologists and also medievalists they've worked under the delusion that this is an innovation that was just created by Europeanists while they were becoming more scientific, you know, in the late 12th, early 13th century, with this, you know, this Renaissance, they call it, at that period, early Renaissance. And so that they sort of did it themselves. And that's basically what everybody's been trying to do in medieval studies has been to show, well, it comes from this or it comes from that, you know. But apparently never suspecting that it was just sitting there in these beautiful Latin, very important texts. Avicenna's works were overwhelmingly important in that early 13th century. They're quoted by all the great writers of the time on philosophy and theology and things like that. But I don't know. I think I may have gotten off track, but that's what I...
That's great. So let's actually get right into the book now. This discussion of this method actually brings us beautifully into the first set of things that that I wanted to ask you about. So for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, and it just came out, so it's possible that that's a lot of people, the book is centrally concerned with medieval science, which, you know, was largely conducted in the form of public disputations, both oral and written. And it's this theme of the form of science, or of science as form, that's going to lead us through the rest of the chapters. And that is, I think, itself a really interesting contribution to the way we understand the history of science. Now, in the course of the book, you're arguing that science, and perhaps medieval science in particular, is characterized not by its content, but by its methodology. So this is something that will, I think, keep coming back to in spirit of our conversation, if not explicitly necessarily. Mm-hmm. What I'll ask you about. So a central part of this methodology is the recursive argument method. And you know that this has been called, or a sort of version of this has been called the scholastic method in previous scholarship or in other scholarship. So because so much of the book is about the recursive argument method, or what we can alternately call recursive argument or the recursive method, could you start us off on this road by explaining a little bit for listeners what this is? What is the recursive argument method before we get sort of into what happens with it and the reasons why it's important?
Okay. Well, the best way to understand it, I think, is to just to briefly describe what normal argument structure is in most books and just long articles, things like that, that people write about, mostly scientific topics, but anything, actually. And that is, most books are written, as you know, if you read a book on, a modern book on science, they're written as just straight text, standard prose. It starts at the beginning, proceeds through the middle, until you reach the end and you stop. You know, you may have divided it into different chapters. Sometimes the chapters are for different topics, but typically it's just often it was just for convenience to break up the length of it, so it's somehow seems more manageable. It's not just one long endless text, and I call that treatise format. And so Aristotle's works are more or less, all, not completely, but almost completely written in treatise format. Other scholars, thinkers, such as Plato, just before Aristotle, and many other ancient Greeks, they liked to use what's called the dialogue format. And Galileo used the dialogue format in the Renaissance. And many others have used it. And that's... It looks like there are two people or three people or four people, whatever, participating in this dialogue. And there's all, but there's always one key figure, the leading figure, the great philosopher, the great thinker, whoever it is, who's basically the alter ego of the writer. And, or his teacher. Sometimes it's presented as if it's his teacher. Plato's always putting everything in the mouth of Socrates. But in any case, and then the other people are just there to kind of keep the story going and to ask questions and to prod the main character into saying something. So it looks like it's an ABAB or ABACA, you know, whatever structure. But in fact, those Bs and Cs, the other people are just there for decoration, kindly, and to make it more interesting, I suppose, to read. I mean, I love reading Plato. When I was in high school, I read complete works of Plato just because I liked his style. I'm not sure how much I understood of what he was saying. It's basically a treatise style. It's a treatise, not style, but it's a treatise argument in structure. So it's not really fundamentally different. The thing about the recursive argument method, which was once upon a time was known pretty clearly to most people as a scholastic method, but it's that meaning, and that term no longer has much meaning for most people now. So some people call it the disputed questions argument. That's the based on a Latin expression that's used for the actual texts. I have that in the title sometimes. Anyhow, the way it works is a recursive argument is an argument about an argument about an argument, or an argument about an argument about an argument about an argument about an argument, etc. This is a kind of a literary form of recursion. Recursion is most easily understood maybe visually when you have you looked at a Matryoshka doll, the Russian nesting dolls. You have the little wooden dolls. You open up, you unscrew the top of one, and inside there's another little doll. That's a little bit smaller. You unscrew the top of that one, there's another one inside, and so on until you get to the smallest one inside, which doesn't unscrew anymore. It's just a solid little doll, and that's the base case, they call it, in the computer science type recursion. Anyhow, that base case is actually the one that you can't go beyond. In the recursive argument method, that's the first argument. So it seems to be structured in reverse order in the recursive argument method. So you give it the basic argument, the main topic, which is usually given as a question. So it is asked whether or not, the sun goes around the moon, or the moon goes around the sun, or the earth goes around the moon, or the earth goes around the sun, something like this. It's asked whether X, Y, or Z. And then the second part will be arguments that have been made about this argument. So this is actually this whether it is such and such a thing is in fact an argument. So then you ask questions, or people have asked questions about it. And if not enough people have asked questions, or you think of some that haven't been asked, you add those into the whole list. You make a list of these, typically a list. It doesn't have to be more than one, actually. So in fact, the first section can have just after the main argument. The first one can have just one. It can be just one argument. It's possible. And there are examples of it. I give one in the book. But typically it's a list. And that's one of the distinctive things about the recursive argument method is that these two main subsections are lists. Anyway, you give, so Aristotle says this, Plato says that, Galileo says this, you know, Einstein says that, and all the different views, you list them there. And then you put an author's view comes in there, and you say, well, okay, this is in the medieval European one, the author's view usually comes in the middle. And the Arabic view usually comes first. Oftentimes it's in two or three different places within the whole argument. But anyway, in the so medieval European one, then the middle, there's the author's view. Author says, well, I think such and such, you know, and usually there are two opposing and pro and con views, or two types of or sets of views within that first group. And the author follows all pro or con, gives his own view about it. Then you go back to that first list, which I call sub-arguments. In Latin, they call them questionculi, the little questions. See, cute little ones. But anyway, so then after the author's view, then you have the you go back to these sub-arguments, the first ones, and you repeat them in the same order with the same sometimes numbered with numbers, and you say, as for the first one, you know, this is correct because of such and such, that's fine, we agree with that. The second one, you know, is correct. The third one we think is wrong, and the fourth one's wrong, and so on. And they're usually organized in sets, so all pro is in one group and then all con is another group. And typically the answers the most famous medieval works, not all of them, but they typically eliminate, they don't respond to ones that they agree with. In other words, they don't, if they agree with one of the pro views or the con views in the first group, then they don't answer that in the second group. But in a full, really full argument, which you have sometimes, then they respond to all of them and they'll say, I agree with this one, I disagree with that one, and so on. So you go through the entire list again. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, however many there are. Sometimes they're quite long lists. And that's the end. So what it is, in fact, is if you... you have, if you do it in the order in which it appears in the European system, and also in the Arabic system, you start off with it's an argument which is disputed by an argument or arguments, which is disputed, and those arguments are disputed by argument or arguments. Okay, so it's an argument about an argument about an argument, or arguments about an argument. And those arguments are in a numbered list, and not necessarily explicitly numbered, but they're always in the same order. Sometimes they screw them up. Sometimes they get confused, I think, and put them in the wrong order, but the intention was to put them all in the right order. So,
Thank you. Perfect. As you mentioned in the book, this is a method that can be used across topics or fields. So the important thing is not necessarily what is being said or disputed, but rather the way it's being said or disputed. And as we get further into the book, what becomes clear is that this is, if not the only component of what creates the conditions for something that you later describe, and we'll talk about this later, as a fully developed or a full scientific culture, it's certainly one of the crucial components of the development of this particular state in the history of science. Okay, so you mentioned in your description of this recursive argument method the importance of, or you mentioned numbering. And numbering and the importance of numbering comes up at various points throughout the book. But one of the places it comes up is in a discussion of the fondness of Buddhist writers for numbered sets. Now, this brings us to one of the next really interesting parts of the argument and parts of what you're showing in the book, which is that the recursive method developed first among Central Asian Buddhist scholars who developed it in order to disprove the beliefs of other Buddhist sects. And this is elaborated at length in Chapter 4. Can you talk a little bit at this point about the importance of this Buddhist context in developing the recursive method and sort of what this means for your larger argument? And I think I'm asking you to talk about this for many reasons, but in part because I think the history of science more more broadly or more globally, really could use more attention, I think, to the importance of and the role of Buddhist texts and Buddhist scholars and Buddhist practices in developing the history of science. So I think this is a particularly interesting part of the book. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd love for you to say a little bit about that.
Okay. I absolutely agree, first of all, that scientists and philosophers as well really have only barely touched the surface of the Buddhist tradition. There's so much there. And my current book that I'm working on is directly involved with that. So we can maybe talk about that later. But so far as this issue of the numbered sets, I wonder when that really started. It certainly didn't start with the Buddha himself, and almost nobody thinks that it did. But at some point, probably fairly early in any case, by the time we start having written texts, they didn't really start writing anything down about Buddhist teachings or connected ideas until long after the Buddha's lifetime. And it seems that the numbering thing may have been an Indian idea. It probably was. I assume it was fairly early, the development of Buddhism. But it's at this point almost impossible to say much about Buddhism before the Kushan Empire period. That was between the late, around about the AD-BC divide. That's when it begins, and it lasts for a couple of centuries. And a little bit before the Shaka period as well. So they were Central Asian people. And in fact, their homeland was Bactria and as an empire. And they spread across northern India. So, and also into East Turkestan all the way, at least as far as Turfan. So they had a big impact on peoples around them, and they helped facilitate the spread of Buddhism. But what we know as Buddhism, traditional Buddhism, almost everything, the literature, seems to come mostly out of this period, the Shaka Kushan period. And some of it is thought, many people think that it reflects a much earlier period as well, and it might. But so what I'm just getting at is that it's difficult to say much about how the numbering thing usages and scientific ideas might have been in a purely Indian context without the Kushans. I personally don't think that it happened there at all. The most important sect of Buddhism, the one which was really devoted to what they call Abhidharma in Sanskrit, which means a sort of analysis of Buddhism, analysis of things, an analysis of Buddhism as well, and in a very scientific way. They had a way of thinking about things which was different from all other Buddhist traditions, and they just wanted to figure out the details and list everything, and the listing probably was already there, but if it wasn't, they certainly did it more than anybody else. They did it into the ground, you know, so to speak. And the Dharma, this kind of, there's so many passions and there's so many practices of this and there's so many that's and this and that's, all the numbers, not just the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and so forth, but just their early works that they wrote that we still have. Most of them have, the earliest ones are thought to be lost, but we have some of them that are considered to be fairly early. That means the very end of maybe the first century BC, something like that. Those texts are full of these lists of things, and they just read like lists, and page after page, and very complicated topics that require commentaries. So doing the lists was, you know, okay, we got lists, but in order to really do something with this material and to develop it more, presumably those were just ways of remembering the material. And so it was a sort of mnemonic device for these lists. And the actual, most of the material was learned orally and was remembered. It wasn't written down. So when they started writing commentaries, then you end up with this, the lists of things became very important. So everything was analyzed according to lists. So they would list all the different positions. I think this is where this comes from, is from commentary literature. And the earliest work I was able to find, and I think this is the earliest work that is preserved, it's preserved only in Chinese translation, is called the Ashtagranta, the eight-limbed, is what it means. That's one of the reconstructions of it, actually. There is another reconstruction which means something entirely different. But this text just consists of these lists of attempts to clarify different points of the Dharma, the Buddhist teaching, lists of them and lists of positions, you know, so many, that would be 10, 15, 20 arguments about one thing. And then they'll turn around and then they'll just list them all again and then argue against them, you know, or argue for or against them. So it's the guts of the recursive argument method. It just, I think, developed out of this commentary literature. But I think if he hadn't had this predilection for listing and numbering the lists as well, it wouldn't have developed the way it did. But this is just my suspicion. And so far as I know, nobody has studied this. I'm sure that there are some Chinese and Japanese scholars who specialize in arcane Buddhist texts that they've looked at this work. And possibly they've even written things on it. But I wasn't successful in finding out anything more. I'm too far away from that field. So I can't tell you a whole lot more. It's something that's really a big desideratum. I think that's something that needs to be done.
Oh, that's great. And I think it signals in the book a space for much, much more work, hopefully by other people to come and develop this point of importance of Buddhist materials to the history of science. So I think even if the book just stopped there, it would be a really great contribution. But it doesn't stop there. And one of the other things that comes in to this set of arguments that you're making as we come to the later chapters and the sort of larger implications of this for understanding sort of global patterns of history of science is, so in addition to the recursive method, the other major development that you explore is that of the college, which appeared at the same time in Western Europe as about the same time, as you say here, as recursive argument. So let's talk about that for a bit before we bring these strands together. So first of all, what is the structure of the college as you mean it here? Because it's actually quite distinct from what we typically think of as sort of a college, I'm using air quotes here, in the context of a modern college or university. So what do you mean by college here?
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, what I mean by college there is the traditional sense of college in English. When you, if you're familiar with, you may not be familiar with, but if one were familiar with the English system in the old universities, Oxford and Cambridge in particular, and but some of the others as well, I think most of them have colleges. The university is a sort of a superstructure. Corporation, and that was the medieval system, which has sort of been preserved, especially at Oxford and Cambridge. And the colleges were each, there are many, many colleges. They were founded by different donors who made a bequest to a number of scholars, and it's a inalienable. Well, I don't know if it's inalienable, but anyway, it's a tax free donation to establish and fund a college, which is an institution that paid for students, a small number of students, usually just a dozen, two dozen, something like that, typically. And a master, sometimes more than one master, a library, and so on. By the time it got to England, it was certainly a building. The first one that we know in Western Europe was established in Paris in late 11th, 12th century. They first had quarters in an existing building, but a couple of decades later, they had gotten their own building. So this is normal that they had their own building. They owned the building. So this college foundation, you might call it, Pius Foundation. They owned the building. They had a fund of money to pay for the students and the teachers and food and drink and so on. All the basics. It was kind of a self enclosed, or was it all included, all inclusive sort of package, and a miniature version, you might say, of one of our universities or colleges, a very, very small one. But once you've started getting more of those, then you have a more of a, enough scholars that besides students, that you can have an academic community, you might say, a scholastic community where people have disputations with each other, as well as training the students how to do it. Because this is one of the main things that they did. One of the main methods of education in those colleges. And this goes right back to, of course, the European one. I'm talking about the European one, but it's the same. It was the same in the medieval and classical Arabic ones, the madrasas. Mm-hmm. Not what the word is used to mean today in some places in the Islamic world. The Buddhist ones that they simply had modified and made Islamic after the Central Asia converted to Islam. So they were doing the same thing. They were arguing and disputing these disputations. That's how most of the education was done orally. But they had a small library. Sometimes they had a big library if it was a big madrasa or a big vihara. The Buddhist ones were called viharas. In this mini college, it was a college in our sense, but very small. So if you talk about a college like a small university, our colleges in America are actually small universities. But the university, so-called university, at the time when these colleges were first built in Western Europe, the so-called university wasn't a university at all. And you read many histories, they say, oh, the Europeans first, they developed the university. And after that, then they might mention the colleges, but usually they're just forgotten about. I was very puzzled when I was working on this and had to read a lot of literature about history of education, educational institutions in Western Europe. And it's pretty well understood in the specialist literature that the college was a very important new thing that just appears in the late 12th century. And they started building one after the other. It was a very good idea. The university itself was like a trade union. It was nothing like what we call a university. Nothing like it. The only thing they had that's similar to our university is that they had the right to or the power to license, give people a license to teach. So, in other words, hand out degrees. And that was it. And it was a group of scholars and included the students as well. So the colleges were completely different. They had their own buildings. The university didn't have its own buildings. The college had the students and the teachers lived together in the same place, and they still do in those colleges at Oxford and Cambridge. So, and in Central Asia, the building itself took on a special form in antiquity, Buddhist design of a college. And this was spread by the Kushans in various directions, and it continued to develop in Central Asia until just before Islam. It developed the form, exactly the form of the classic madrasa, the Islamic college, which, you know, continued the early Buddhist one, but simply as an Islamic institution, they're identical and very special architectural form. It's very interesting. When it got to Europe, it seems that they used this architectural form as well, but I can't say that it, you know, was transmitted at the same time, but probably along with everything else that the Europeans were just fascinated with everything coming from the classical Arabic and Islamic world, and they adopted just about everything they could. It was all the cool stuff, you know, the great stuff. And that was one of the things I guess they adopted too.
I'll mention also here that you've just mention the importance of the architectural forms here, and I'll just kind of signal for listeners who are interested in the history of architecture, history of archaeology as well. There's a really interesting moment in that discussion where you're
engaging these different, I mean, these kinds of forms of evidence that we don't often see incorporated into history of science arguments in a really, really interesting way. So I particularly like this discussion for all kinds of reasons, but in including the really, I think, expert weaving together of very different forms of evidence to come up with this this argument structure. Yeah.
Okay. I mentioned that that's one of those many things that need to be studied in Western European things. I couldn't find any. Maybe there is something out there, but I looked and could not find any professional studies of the early history of the cloister. These things are called cloisters. And if you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, a branch of it, in New York, it's outside the middle of the city. I think it's not in the middle of the city, but there's this part of it. It's called the cloisters. Mm-hmm. And it's all these beautiful medieval cloisters from monasteries, I think, which were dismantled and brought, some rich man donated them, dismantled and brought to the United States and set up there. And you can go walk around the cloister and see how it is if you happen to be in New York.
I was when I was a kid, my parents used to take me to the cloisters, and I used to steal the oranges off all those beautiful, fragrant orange trees that they have around and take them home and get yelled at. You can't eat those. Stop you stealing all the oranges. But anyway, I digress. So that discussion is really, really, really interesting. And once we get to that point where you're showing that rather than understanding the college as emerging independently in Western Europe, once we understand that it actually came from the Vihara of Central Asia via the Islamic madrasa, an entire chapter of the book is devoted to explicating when, where, and how Muslims adopted these two elements that we've been talking about, the recursive argument and the college from Central Asia. And so this gets us into a really interesting discussion of Central Asia as an important space for exchange and for the kind of exchange that I think we don't really understand fully yet, right? Which is a space for something we might call scientific exchange, or we might not call it scientific exchange, and that, you know, depending on how you want to position yourself in the history of science, and we'll also get to that at the end of our discussion, I'm sure. Okay, so you're showing in this chapter and in this section of the book that a lot of the features of classical Arabic civilization, kind of broadly construed, actually developed from Central Asian models, mm-hmm. including you mentioned here a distinctive Islamic version of atomism, which is, I think, really interesting for historians of science. You also mentioned here that many of the great scholars and scientists of the classical age of Islam were Central Asians, were not Arabs, were not Syrians, or were not Persians. They were actually Central Asians. So I'd love it if you could talk about that a little bit, because that itself was a really pleasant, kind of wonderful surprise for me when I was reading through this.
It's a good question, and it's a topic that deserves a whole book, and I believe it's getting one. There is a scholar who's I cited a paper of his, Fred Starr, published a paper a couple of years ago on I guess Science in Central Asia or something like that. I've forgotten the title. And it was designed to be read by, you know, popular audience. But it's very interesting. He put his finger on a lot of the key points. And he does make the mistake of calling a lot of these people Persians or whatever instead of Central Asians. And there basically weren't any Persians, maybe one or two. In the early period, in the period of developmental period, most of the great scholars came from Central Asia, and very often quite far out, like Khwarezm, which is up there by the Aral Sea, on the edges of it, you might say. So in the area of what was already becoming Turkestan, it wasn't completely yet, but their Turkic peoples had been migrating in that area for some time. So these were different people, and they had quite different traditions and a different way of looking at things. And I think I lost your question.
No. That's perfectly fine. It's I wanted to sort of use this to sort of segue us into the perhaps the final set of questions that I wanted to ask you anyway. So, but I'll just mention very briefly one of the writers that you talk about in discussing the importance of Central Asians to sort of the history of scholarship and the history of science was Ibn Sina or Avicenna. And one of the really interesting things that comes out of this that I won't ask you to talk too much, or I won't ask you to talk about at all, but I'll just signal as one of the really interesting threads in the book that comes out perhaps implicitly, he actually learned the recursive method from a legal scholar, as you tell us in the book. And one of the I think, interesting threads throughout the book that starts in the preface and continues throughout is occasionally the chapters come back to the relevance of law and of legal history to the history of the recursive argument method in medieval Latin, in classical Arabic, and in early Indic texts. And that's just sort of another possible set of issues that would be really interesting, I think.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And I mentioned, I think, in the preface somewhere that, boy, if there's anything I don't understand, it's law. And I don't understand it in English, really. And the whole colleagues of mine are interested in it. I get into arguments sometimes, but I try to get out of them because I don't understand law and I don't even like law. So it's very difficult for me to deal with. But this is absolutely right. There is something, but the law that we taught that these texts talk about aren't really, it's not really the kind of law that we usually think of, you know, it's not the law of torts or whatever, inheritance law, stuff like that. It's the kind of, it's not exactly, it's not even canon law. I think I even compared it to canon law at some point. It's not really like that, but something more like that. But it's more like Sharia in Islam. That was never a system of law that was actually ever put into practical use anytime until very recent times with this fundamentalism. And people started trying to implement actually this Islamic law. It was an ideal sort of law. It was sort of a, it wasn't the thing you actually did. If you got in trouble with the law, somebody accused you of stealing something or, you know, whatever, normally you went to the court, there was a judge, and it was all secular law from early Islamic period right down to the recent times. They had their own secular law code. So it's like if you're accused of stealing something in the department store, you're not going to go to the cops are not going to take you to the local church and tell you to, you know, see the priest who's going to go check through canon law and the law of theft, you know. But this is so it's something completely different, and it makes it even more difficult for me to understand, in a sense, what they were really doing. But yes, law is something. I don't think this is where the method really comes from originally, but because Buddhists, they were living in monasteries. The vihara was, it's the same word for monastery. So we say vihara is a college. Yes, it was a college, but it's also can be translated and often is translated as monastery. It's where the monks lived, and they studied there as well, of course, and taught there too, did all sorts of things. But so then the rule, the monk's rule, just like the rule of Saint Benedict for Benedictine monks, that's an important thing. And they had to know about it. They had to, you know, follow it, and they all learned it. So that's it's a very small part of this. And I think it's not the key thing, but the interesting thing is that yes, Avicenna learned it from an Islamic teacher of jurisprudence and orally. Learn how to dispute using this method. And that's what he describes very vividly. So it was just being used that way. What it had to do with law per se, I guess I did. It had, but it was this Islamic law, not the kind of law that the kings, the sultans or whatever of the realm were actually using in their day-to-day work. It wasn't that at all. It was this ideal law. I think that's right. I think that's right.
So what, as we sort of, perhaps the a good place to start coming to the end of our discussion or coming to the conclusion is by looking at the kind of broader argument about the history of science that you're using these different threads to make. And this is coming at the end of the book. You argue here that because the recursive argument method and the college were not fully integrated into the early Islamic world, for example, a full scientific culture or a scientific culture complex didn't develop there. So let's talk about this as a way of bringing this to a conclusion. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about, because you make a distinction here, and there's an entire chapter that explores control cases for trying to understand what it took to produce a fully integrated scientific culture and what the qualities of that were by looking at different cases in which one or more of the components that you are arguing for were actually missing. Could you say a little bit about what you mean here by positing a fully integrated recursive method in college, and how that's related to this idea of a full scientific culture? So what is a full scientific culture or a fully integrated scientific culture? And can you talk about that or the importance of that more broadly for the way you're understanding the history of science in this last part of the book?
Okay, I'll do my best. This is the most controversial part of the book, and all I can do is to present what I have concluded on the basis of that research in that book. So
sure, that's all I'm asking, just to kind of put that out there, because I think whether or not a reader reads this and says, yes, you know, I completely agree with that, or no, I completely disagree with that, it at least presents a place to start looking at this broader set of issues. So I think it's a contribution regardless of whether or not, you know, it's going to be, regardless of whether or not any particular reader agrees or disagrees with the conclusions based on the research, it is a contribution, and it's important perhaps because it's going to be controversial, right? I mean, I think if it weren't controversial, it wouldn't be as useful.
Yeah, well, maybe.
But anyway, so can you talk about that, or what you found, what you concluded on the basis of the research that you did for the book?
Sure. I had to grapple with this the entire time I was working on the book. And when I was working on the revisions after the peer reviews, then I just kept finding additional things. And so I kept thinking about this the whole time and struggling with it. What did I mean by it? You know, I got this concept, and I need to pin it down a little bit more. And by doing the test cases that you referred to, I went through all the different major civilizations that I was familiar with at around that time in history that when this method and the college starts appearing. And I just found that I couldn't find a direct link with those, having those elements, or other things such as Aristotelian science and Aristotelian philosophy or whatever, logic and so forth. None of them seem to really by themselves provide the answer to how science, full science that what we developed in Western Europe, why did it develop there and not die out? And why did it become so entrenched? Why did science sort of characterize practically everything in Western European culture? By the time you get to the Renaissance, you know, you have people painting pictures scientifically, you know, that's what perspective is all about. And chiaroscuro, the light and shade and all that sort of thing. They were looking at things in a particular way, and they talk about their treatises about it, which are which read more like scientific treatises than like anything else sometimes. And everything else was affected by it, this way of looking at the world. Why was it so special? Why did the Europeans do that? Everybody else thought it was just weird, I think, they just simply didn't comprehend it. Whereas the Europeans got to the point where they didn't understand why the rest of the world didn't understand what science is all about. And they thought, oh, they're backward because they don't, you know, have this idea of science. And it's just a special thing that developed there. Yes, well, why? So it occurred to me that at some point that, okay, well, I went through all the different test cases like China and India and Tibet and so on, and the Islamic world, the Greco-Roman world, the Byzantine Empire, they had, the Greeks and Byzantines, they had continuous knowledge of Aristotelian science from the time of Aristotle and his predecessors and all the way down to the fall of the Byzantine Empire in 1453. So we've got well over a millennium of continuous knowledge of Aristotle, but they never developed, anything like what Europeans developed, this full scientific culture. They didn't develop, of course, they didn't develop the college. They didn't have colleges, but and they didn't have the scholastic, the recursive argument method. Was that really crucial? All these other places had the recursive argument method. They did have a college. They even had bits and pieces of Greek science, like Tibet, for example. Why didn't they develop a full scientific culture or scientific culture complex? And I think it might be that the best comparison is not really or the best way of looking at it is not to look at it the way I've just been describing it, trying to figure out by looking at all these test cases and so on. But it came to me while working on the conclusion. There's a recent example, which is an excellent example of how somebody got science, and that's Japan. And the 19th century, the Americans sailed there with their big, powerful ships and forced the Japanese to, which had closed their doors to the outside world for a couple of centuries, and forced them to open up again. And that brought about and the threat of American military, European military, and so on, which was all over East Asia, was such that the Japanese realized we have to do something now. And they had a revolution. The revolution was to put the king back on the throne. This is not the thing people normally imagine as a revolution, but it was a success. He was a progressive thinker, the Emperor Meiji, and he just said, okay, we've got to copy everything those guys are doing. And so they copied everything. Europeans and Americans were doing everything, including the strange clothes, the big top hats, you know, look like stovepipes and all this stuff. And just basically said, okay, we're not going to do this old Japanese stuff anymore. We're going to do this stuff. And within a couple of decades, they had adopted and learned the technology, the basic science, and everything else, legal system, economy, baseball, all kinds of things were developed within a few decades anyway, after this revolution. And it was just all imported en masse, you know, all at once. So, okay, that's a model that if we look at that, think about that as a model, and then go back and look at medieval Europe, which is our only example of a culture that developed this full science before modern times. And then we see what happened. Well, the Crusades were exactly this kind of an event. You know, this massive influx of culture, everything from poetry and song and dance to science was just, you know, everything that came from there was great. It was fabulous. I'm sure fashions and everything were just as important as everything else. And I think this is the reason why it came in all about the same time. And so the college, which had been part of the Islamic civilization, was there, but wasn't being used really for science. But it came over. It was such a good idea. Europeans brought that in as well. That's something intellectual. All the intellectual stuff kind of moved into the same sort of box. You know, there's this category for educational institution, another one for your the way you argue, and another one for the kind of topics you like to argue about, and the past literature about it, the Aristotelian literature especially, and the commentaries on it, and so forth. All that stuff was sort of one category of the Western European culture. And since it was all one category and the church supported it a lot, so it was successful. And I guess that's this is my suspicion, but this is a huge topic. And it's something that if medievalists don't just all dump on this and say, you know, well, you know, it's all wrong. It's not what we think. It's not what we say. You know, I'm a medievalist too, by the way. Say we, they, you know. Right. I shouldn't do that. But anyhow, if they just if medievalists as a whole just say, well, it's, we're not interested, we're going to stick to the old ways because that's the traditional gatekeeper way of doing things, then unfortunately it, you know, won't go anywhere, I think. But I think it needs to be looked at. It needs to be thought about in a different way than has been done before, which has been very piecemeal. So the people doing poetry, for example, they say, well, you know, this Provençal poetry, you know, the troubadours and everything, that was just grew out of a Latin poetry. And he's an example. You can see it, you know, and so on and so on and so on. And that's still argued to this day, you know, whereas it was known in the Middle Ages and down to the present is that the people went there, they came back singing these funny songs from, they went on campaign in Spain, and came back singing different songs with different kinds of lyrics and everything, and it caught on. It was popular stuff. It was just a part of the culture that you got, and it was, you know, a whole part of that whole package. And I think if we look at it, instead of looking at it just piece by piece and say, oh, well, we can always try to find some Aristotelian origin, even though nobody's ever been able to find it, an Aristotelian origin for the recursive argument method, for example. Oh, sure, we can find it in this and that. And we explain things away that way. If you don't do that and try to look at it a little bit with a wider vision, see what was really going on at this point in history. What was this? It was the Crusades. Hello. You know, that was the big event. And everybody was just, you know, involved in them or concerned about them or talking about them. And it lasted for quite a while, and right exactly when this transmission took place. So that's kind of my I didn't make it that clear, I think, in the conclusion, but I keep thinking about some of these topics after the book is done, you know.
Yes, that's great. And I sort of promise that this will be the last question that I ask you before we wrap up. But one of the things, as we come to the close of the book now, one of the things that you do have in the book after the conclusion is you've included a number of appendices. So as perhaps the final question that I ask you before we wrap up, is there anything that you'd like to say about the appendices and the ways that they're important to the larger project and the larger kind of work that you're doing in the book?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, well, I think the first appendix and the one on the charter of the Collège de 18, which is in Latin, which didn't translated. But anyway, I wanted to include that for anybody who might be interested. Those are pretty self-explanatory. But the middle appendix on Peter of Poitiers is turned out to be another topic. Maybe I should have just published that as a separate article. But then, you know, it was growing out of the book. And there's part of it that is directly connected to the book. So I thought, well, I'll just keep it in there and put it in an appendix. But it turned out to be rather important. Because there are several people known as Peter of Poitiers, and they lived at around the same time. Actually, there are ones I talk about explicitly. And the question is, which one wrote the Book of Sentences, it's called, that's ascribed to the one particular Peter of Poitiers. It turned out that the scholarly agreement that it was this one particular guy who wrote this book, and he did this and he did that. Well, certainly, I suppose one guy, one Peter of Poitiers, did write an original text, but that seems to have been it's known to have been reworked in part, probably not by him, but by his students. It's possible that he lived longer than we think, and he did make some of these changes, but more than likely it was done by some of his students. So it was rewritten, and he has examples of this recursive argument in it. Was pointed out to me by a medievalist colleague. So it's very interesting. If the supposed date of the book is as believed, it would make his usage the earliest one in Latin after the translations of the works of Avicenna. But there's so many things wrong with this that as the more I worked on it and looked into this particular, into the work and also to the career and the life and career of Peter of Poitiers, such as it is known, as much as it's known, and the other Peters of Poitiers, it became clear that this is the present picture is simply impossible. There's something wrong with the dates. There's something wrong with the text and its attribution. There's something wrong saying that the particular Peter Poitier, who is said to have written the work, almost couldn't have written that work, even though, you know, he is the one who was the master of theology and so on in Paris. Yes, yes, yes. But and this is where law comes in again. He doesn't say anything about law anywhere in there. But one of the other that's one of the standard things that are it's noticeable by its absence, because all the other writers at that time, they talk a lot about law. I mean, Thomas Aquinas, everybody else, many of their arguments, it's the most disputable things in existence are legal topics, or were. So there are people arguing about them the whole time. And why does Peter of Poitiers, the author of this book, not say anything about legal topics? You know, and he's supposed to have been trained in law, according to the people who have written about it. It doesn't make any sense. But there's another Peter of Poitiers, who was a canon lawyer, and is exactly the right person to have written about law. So that explains that. And then it would say, okay, we can have this one guy write the text about it's about the arguments and so on, and then he didn't know anything about law, and that's why. But then we have problems with separating them out. And if we go back as early as the date that's given for the Peter of Poitiers, who's traditionally said to have written the work, the master of theology, if you go back to the date when it's said to have been dedicated, then you get really close to to another Peter of Poitiers, who was in Spain and was a participant in the translation of Islamic works into Latin from Arabic. So he actually, you know, was there. I think this is just too many coincidences and too many problems for me to take it as it's been received. And the more I looked at it, I found, okay, everything about it, the attribution, almost all the major points all need to be redone. And then I've discovered that the texts themselves, they have not been completely edited, only the first two books of his five books. And they didn't do a good edition. I mean, they didn't take into account the supposed 12th century manuscripts. And there are 12th century manuscripts, you know, so, and they didn't use them. What kind of an edition is it? So it's astounding. This is something which medievalists, mainstream medievalists, really need to do, because the chronology of the late 12th century completely is almost all hinges upon this date, mm-hmm. supposed date of the Peter Poitiers' Books of Sentences, mm-hmm. and so this is just it undoes, you know, the traditional received view, and now it needs to be a new view needs to be put together again. And in order to do that, you're going to have to study and read all this stuff and do a proper critical edition of his work. And so it's just a huge job. But anyway, I thought I should mention it. It's just a little footnote kind of to this book, but it actually in the realm of medieval studies, it's a big topic.
Well, Chris, thank you so much. Now that we've come to the conclusion of talking about the book, is there anything else about the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to point out, especially for listeners perhaps who haven't yet had a chance to read it?
Yes, the cover is awesome.
The cover is awesome.
Yes, the cover is a Renaissance painting. It's beautiful, and the Princeton University Press, the designers made it a really beautiful cover out of it. So you can see it if you look on the Princeton site or on the Amazon or any of the other sites that have books. I suppose you'll have a picture of it.
That's right. We will. We'll have a picture of the cover on our site too. So.
Yeah, and the full painting has all kinds of great stuff which got cut off in the detail that they put in. It's like there's some strange birds walking around and all kinds of great stuff.
Oh, really? Maybe I'll try to find a full version of that.
Yeah.
Great. Well, so now that this book is out, and congratulations again on the book, what's next for you? What project is currently inspiring you at the moment?
Yeah, well, most of my other projects, they sort of connected one, as I suggested, one leads to another, you know. And while working on this one, I got interested in an old topic that I was interested in already in college, undergraduate times, and I was interested in ancient Greek skepticism, which is properly known as Pyrrhonism, the earliest form of it, named after Pyrrho of Elis, was a Greek philosopher who went to India with Alexander the Great and came back and taught this very unusual, radically different form of thought. And there was nothing like it before that. And there has been some work recently done on Pyrrho, and I've done some of it myself. I published an article on his logic, based on the Greek sources. But it's bigger than that. I mean, it's really connected with contact of an interpenetration of these of Hellenistic world, Hellenistic thought, and Central Asian and Indian thought. And there are people who've worked on it a little bit, but it needs somebody to work on it who is specialized a little bit in that area. I'm not sure I'm a specialist in anything anymore, but I've thought about it for a long time anyway, and I'm interested in it, and I'm willing to spend the time to work on this. And it's one of some of the major source material texts are in Greek. Mm-hmm. So that, and of course also in early Indic sources. So I've been working on this, and a little bit even in Chinese, actually. So I think it's an exciting project, and I haven't got a great title for it yet. I think I have a good main title, but the subtitle is so long, it's giving me trouble. But yeah, anyhow, something like that. That's my next project.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for talking with me about the book today. It's a really important book. It's a really inspiring book, and I'm excited to have had the chance to talk to you about it, and best of luck with your current project.
Well, thank you very much, and it was nice talking to you, Carla, and best of luck with your series.
Thank you. You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.